You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The last 2 months have seen a lot of change in Egypt ever since democratically elected President Mohamed Morsi was ousted and then arrested on July 3rd. He's been replaced with a government installed by the military, and since then, the police have violently cracked down on protesters, killing more than 1,000 and arresting many of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. And earlier today, former Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak was released from prison after 17 months in captivity following his overthrow in 2011. Joining me now from Cairo for a look at Egypt's unfolding political situation from the ground are Ashraf Khalil, a correspondent for Time magazine and the author of the book Liberation Square, and Charles Levinson, Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them back to our show. Hello.
Hello.
Yesterday, an Egyptian court struck down the last barrier to releasing former President Hosni Mubarak from prison, and today he was placed under house arrest. Since Egypt's judiciary has never been particularly independent of the political system, do we know if that was at the request of the government that was installed by General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi? Let's begin with you, Charles.
I mean, I think it's really difficult to know exactly what's going on behind the scenes inside this regime, but certainly the judiciary, is closely, powerful elements of the judiciary are closely linked to the Mubarak regime, and certainly the timing of this decision and, the way it's played out in the, as part of this broader crackdown and basically this counter-revolution that's unfolding, certainly, leads one to believe that if it wasn't...
We are going to probably be experiencing a number of difficulties because we are speaking to these two men from Cairo. Are you still there, Ashraf?
I am still here. I can still hear you, Leonard.
Okay. Do you want to add to that? Mubarak's release seemed to have been expected by some, but there is some symbolism in the fact that he was released just as so many of the other changes after the revolution have been reversed.
Well, yeah, the symbolism and the visuals are really bad because this is coming at a time when the Muslim Brotherhood and the supporters of deposed President Mohamed Morsi are all claiming that the military's move against Morsi was in fact a disguised counter-revolution to bring the back into power. So Mubarak coming free at right this time feeds right into that narrative. Now, as far as how we judge the behavior of the Egyptian judiciary, as Charles said, it's a little mysterious, but I think we can conclude that the judiciary has been at least the
yes
charges. Charges like the charges against Mohamed Morsi that are sort of a very paper thin excuse to keep him under wraps and in custody. So the fact that the judiciary is largely viewed as a political entity is one of the reasons people have such a hard time believing that this is just a coincidence, even if it is.
Well, isn't there a big problem here in talking about democracy? Because Morsi was democratically elected, but the ouster seemed to be rather popular with a large segment of the population because they felt that he was becoming increasingly undemocratic.
Well, that is the perspective of the military and the people who very angrily, when people like me, Charles, or any other correspondent use the word coup, it has produced an immediate and angry and defensive response, because the argument is that Morsi lost the right to rule over the course of his year. When he took her powers and saw judges and basically rammed through in between November and January,
but
that was highly divisive. So
yeah, we're having a bit of problems with your.
This is what
we're having a bit of problem with your phone, Ashraf, as we have had with Charles. But Charles, we're in a situation now where some of the people who protested against Hosni Mubarak were also in favor of getting rid of Morsi, and now they're caught in the middle, aren't they?
Yeah, I think you've definitely seen, this element of the Egyptian sort of, people, the activist scene that is sort of has sort of gone back and forth and isn't quite sure where it comes down. They were very pro-revolution in the beginning, obviously, and then the Muslim Brotherhood, and they were even supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood at a certain time, if reluctantly. You know, certainly Morsi won the presidency in part because certain elements of the secular activist community, you know, voted for him as because they preferred a Muslim Brother candidate over the old regime candidate, and then they very much turned against the Muslim Brotherhood and supported the ouster of Morsi and supported the military, and the military that they had been denouncing for so long, suddenly they were standing arm in arm with. And then within, didn't take long after the ouster of Morsi for them to suddenly realize, whoa, what have we backed? What's happening? And, first it was the crackdown on protesters and hundreds were killed. And then it was, emergency law back. And now it's the release of Mubarak. And they've sort of, they're constantly, ping-ponged back and forth between the two sides. And it's, and that's sort of been one of the things that has sort of doomed this, the revolution or the continuing democratic process here in Egypt.
Ashraf, we spoke to both of you during the protest 2 years ago. He's not there. I'm sorry. Well, what is the mood like now, Charles? Is it fear, anger, frustration, all of the above?
Yeah, it's super polarized. It's a lot of, a lot of people are really, a lot of people who are sort of longtime activists and who've been fighting for democracy for a long time are really sort of, I'd say, just depressed. I mean, really sort of, really depressed about how things have played out and what's happened. I mean, certainly a lot of, the high hopes of this revolution, that existed when we last spoke, at the time of the protest in 2011, are gone, have been shattered. And you've really seen sort of a real regression to, what it was like during the Mubarak era, and even in many respects worse. I mean, even the Mubarak era, we never saw these kind of death tolls. We never saw the head of the Muslim Brotherhood arrested. Mubarak would arrest a lot of the rank and file, but the top leaders were usually immune, and we're really seeing sort of a crackdown on a scale that we haven't seen in this country since probably the mid-1950s.
So, Ashraf, was Badi's arrest a sign that the military-led government is going farther than the Mubarak regime did in cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood?
Yeah, I think we can safely say that we're going into uncharted territory as far as the government's efforts to repress the Brotherhood. I mean, there have been times in the past, as Charles said, Charles and I were both here, maybe a decade ago in Egypt when, and witnessed the Mubarak treatment of the Brotherhood. And then it was kind of almost routine. Like every 6 months or so, they'd round up a bunch of mid-level brothers, put them on a show trial. But it always felt like they weren't really trying to cripple the organization. And you could tell when, one point that sticks out in my mind from the late Mubarak years was 2007, when the government arrested Khayrat al-Shatr, who was a very powerful financier and ideologue within the Brotherhood, who has since risen to deputy guide and was actually one of their presidential candidates last year, who was disqualified, and then Mohamed Morsi came in. And Khayrat al-Shatr was a really critical figure in the Brotherhood. And so in 2007, when they were arrested, everybody sat up and said, oh, this is not the usual game. This is the government really trying to cripple the Brotherhood. And now they've taken it one step further. Not only is Khayrat al-Shatr in jail, the general guide, that, they're basically running out of senior leaders, which is not only going to affect the functioning of the Brotherhood, it's going to affect their decision-making at a time when they're under pressure to make some very big decisions.
Well, Mohamed Badi is being held for 15 days while they investigate whether he has incited violence. Should we assume that the Muslim Brotherhood is behind all of the violence, including the attacks on the country's Coptic Christians who have been targeted by Islamists for supporting Morsi's ouster? First you, Ashraf, and then you, Charles.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, of course.
All right. We cannot lay all of the violence at the feet of the Brotherhood. Certainly, some of it is independent actors who may have been perhaps inspired, which would speak to the incitement. I actually find it difficult to believe that attacks on the churches. It was such a comprehensive series of attacks on churches. I find it hard to believe that that would be ordered from the Brotherhood leadership as a direct order. I think it's much more likely that these were individual citizens who are responding to the language put out by their leaders, because it really works against their purposes, the church attacks especially. The Brotherhood for the past month has basically given up on domestic public opinion. I think they recognize that Egyptian public opinion majority had turned against them. So they've been working the international community. They've been working the foreign correspondents. They've been working foreign governments, international human rights organizations, and sort of playing for sympathy there. And there's nothing that will lose them that sympathy faster than a bunch of burned down churches. So we can lay some of the blame on them, but I think there's things happening that are outside of their control that the government would claim that they've been inciting their people and now they've lost control of them, and so they bear responsibility for that.
On the other hand, Charles, the Muslim Brotherhood took a long time to condemn the attacks, which some people might interpret as tacit support. But then again, the Coptic Christian community seems to be blamed for everything that goes wrong in Egypt from all sides.
I mean, I agree with Ashraf. I think it's highly unlikely that the Brotherhood leadership would have ordered the attacks on churches. It just doesn't jive with, you know, the organization that I've dealt with for the past 10 years. And it's interesting, you know, if you look at why the regime during the Mubarak era didn't arrest top leaders, it was because, you know, the regime wanted to weaken the group, wanted to send messages, but it also wanted the group to maintain discipline and control so that they could count on the Brotherhood to continue playing by sort of the unspoken rules of this power struggle between the regime and the Brotherhood. And that in order for the Brotherhood to function as a, you know, cohesive, disciplined movement, you needed a leadership in place that could give orders and that would be listened to. And I think there's, you know, I think now in this sort of new uncharted territory we're in, and this real, you know, far more sweeping crackdown on the Brotherhood than we've seen in decades, I think, you know, certainly there's an argument to be made that it benefits the regime to have, you know, the Brotherhood being portrayed and being seen as violent terrorists and indeed, you know, starting to turn to violence, you know, helps their cause in terms of helping to portray the Brotherhood as this, you know, sort of very violent group. And I think, you know, you're seeing them go after the leadership, and I think part of the consequences of cracking down on the leadership is that there isn't the same sort of control over the rank and file, over the, you know, the fringe elements of the group, whatever, that you know, the Brotherhood has historically had. And I think that could also be, you know, partly explain why suddenly a group that, you know, was never openly attacking Christians in this kind of way, you know, suddenly you're seeing elements, you know, of it starting to turn to these sort of violent attacks against churches and the like.
Ashraf, wasn't there talk about some kind of a peace offer made by the Muslim Brotherhood to work things out with the military that was squelched by the military?
Well, I mean, we're getting sort of conflicting reports of who offered what and who was willing to accept what. I know that the Brotherhood, fairly early on, the Brotherhood was floating trial balloons for the shape of something they would consider as a reconciliation, and that basically it consisted of Mohamed Morsi returns to the presidency and then scheduled early elections, or Morsi returns to the presidency and then hands off a chunk of his powers to a technocrat national consensus cabinet. But all of the Brotherhood scenarios began with Morsi returns to the presidency and then we'll start talking about cutting short his term or curbing his powers. And that was the red line for everybody else, was Morsi returning to the presidency. So really, the negotiations never got past square one because they always were stuck on everybody's red line involved the fate of Mohamed Morsi.
We will take a little break and come back with more with our guests talking to us from Cairo. Ashraf Khalil, a correspondent for Time magazine, the author of the book Liberation Square, and Charles Levinson, the Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Stay with us. We are back with Charles Levinson, Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Ashraf Khalil, a correspondent for Time magazine, the author of the book Liberation Square. Weren't many people surprised when Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohamed El-Baradei initially agreed to work with the military and was named interim vice president on July 14? Ashraf?
It was not a big surprise, because he, for a couple of weeks, maybe even months before then, had been like very strongly anti-Morsi, pushing for an early departure and kind of making overtures to even some of the Mubarak regime people. In the final days before June 30th, before this whole crisis kicked off with the massive protests on June 30th, the opposition held a conference called After the Departure. They were already planning for Morsi's departure in June 26th or so. And at that conference, Baradei, you know, specifically said, can't freeze out everyone who was ever part of Mubarak's party. I mean, he was laying out olive branches for what became this kind of union between the liberal opposition, the military, and a lot of former Mubarak people against the Brotherhood. And so it's not a huge surprise that he took part, but it was also very vital, his presence in this transitional coalition government, because he was basically their most high-profile international advocate. I mean, he's a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, and he was the one willing to put his reputation on the line and say, this was not a coup, this was necessary. This was unfortunate, but it was necessary to save the country from a cliff that we were about to go over under Morsi. And the fact that he was willing to put his name and his credibility on that line in the international stage, he was a very necessary player. So now he's gone, and the regime has, you know, the current government has lost a very high-profile advocate.
And Charles, he left just a month later in the wake of the violent crackdown on protesters that left more than 1,100 people dead. Is that an indication of how fluid the political situation is in Egypt at this time?
I suppose an indication of how fluid it is, and I think it's dealt with below to Baradei's, you know, credibility. To sort of understand the political game here, you have to, you know, there's three locuses of power in Egypt. You have the state, the military, the old regime, you know, the Mubarak, all that whole sort of circle. You have sort of the liberal, secular, non-Islamist opposition, which is, you know, Baradei represents in this case. And then you have sort of the Islamist, not the opposition, the Muslim Brotherhood being the most prominent. And, you know, in Egypt for decades, and not just Egypt, throughout the Middle East, the way regimes have managed the managed holding on to powers by, you know, making sure basically that, you know, the other two never united against it, because basically no one of those three can rule on its own. They need, you know, you need two against one, basically. And so the regime has always made sure that to split off, keep those two split. And the reason Mubarak fell in 2011 was basically the Islamists and the non-Islamist opposition came together, united, and overthrew Mubarak. And then what you saw sort of the military sort of ally with, or, you know, be seen to be allying with the Brotherhood sort of against the secular opposition. The Brotherhood, you know, ascended on that. And then it turned on the Brotherhood and sort of allied with the secular opposition. And then you saw Morsi ousted. That's sort of, you see the regime sort of going back to those same tactics and doing it really well and outmaneuvering both the Islamists and the secular opposition, who don't seem to realize that this is the game and they have to just, you know, put aside their differences in order to sort of defeat the state and get a new game in town. And I think, you know, what Ashraf is talking about is sort of the rapprochement between El Baradei and the military and then the old regime figures in the months leading up to Morsi's ouster. Sort of part of this,
you know,
repositioning of those.
But then now, Ashraf, El Baradei will be tried next month on charges of breaching national trust simply because he quit the regime. He's fled the country, hasn't he?
Well, I'd argue with the word fled, but he's not here anymore. Yeah, he's in Austria with his family. And the charges against him, the thing you have to understand about one of the quirks of the Egyptian legal system is that basically any lawyer can raise a civil suit against anybody for almost any reason, and it ends up on the desk of the prosecutor. If the prosecutor then agrees to pick that up and take that further and investigate that, then you've got a real case. And so right now we're still at the stage where basically a lawyer has raised a nuisance lawsuit against Baradei for, I believe, the charge is breaching the national trust, whatever that means. So it hasn't gone to that next stage, I think, where he's actually facing trial for it. But but it is out there. And it's indicative, if anything, of the backlash against Baradei that kicked in even before he left. When he started criticizing the violent methods that were being used to suppress the Brotherhood, you saw this. I mean, I like Charles's analogy quite a bit about these three factions, and any two can gang up on the third. And what you've got here is basically the non-Islamist revolutionaries teamed up with the Mubarak remnants and the military against this third leg, against the Brotherhood. And that's why what happened. But now if you get Baradei and his crowd, they team up with the regime and the military, and then they fall out with them over tactics and take their ball and go home, well, then the end result is you basically handed the country back to the regime and the military.
And then, of course, we have the symbolism of Hosni Mubarak being released from prison in the midst of all of this. My guests are Ashraf Khalil, a correspondent for Time magazine, author of the book Liberation Square, and Charles Levinson, Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And then there's the whole matter, Charles, of the Obama administration's response to this. At first, they seemed to support the military's actions and refused to call it a coup. But in light of the violent crackdown, Obama has said that his administration will review aid to Egypt, not necessarily suspend it. The Egyptian military is heavily dependent on the $1.3 billion they receive in American aid. But my sense from reading your newspaper is that both sides are blaming Obama for messing it up.
No question. I mean, the sort of the frustration and the anger at U.S. policy and sort of the blaming the Americans for their plight is equally vitriolic on both sides, which is, I guess sort of tough to comprehend from the outside. And even us on the ground sometimes have a hard time comprehending all the logic behind sort of the arguments. I mean, as someone who's been here for 10 years, I found it particularly frustrating. I mean, not as a defense for the Obama administration policy, because I think the idea that it's been very sort of, ambiguous at times and back and forth is a fair criticism.
Well,
Is
it similar to his caution in responding to events in Syria?
I think that you could definitely see similarities in the approach of sort of not quite committing to one or the other, and as a sense just sort of being seen to be sort of muddling through in a sort of a neither this nor that middle road, which proves sort of ineffective in the end. But the U.S. is also in a tough position because, all right, you can cut off the military aid, but the Egyptians have gone to the Saudis and other Gulf countries and have gotten pledges of, many more billions of dollars of aid than the U.S. gives each year. Israel is standing pretty firmly behind the military on this. And so, with Saudi Arabia and Israel both sort of backing the military, both those countries are Washington's two closest allies in the region. Any president is going to have his hands, is going to be pretty handcuffed in terms of what he can do. And so, the U.S. is just facing a situation where it doesn't have the leverage it wishes it had in Egypt.
Is this the first time in recent memory that the Saudis and the Israelis have agreed on a regional policy?
Well, they found some common ground on Iran. Of course, they kept it pretty, it wasn't very public, but certainly any diplomat or anybody working in the region is, well aware that the Israelis and the Saudis were both pretty vehement about the need to confront Iran's nuclear program. But, this has brought them even closer, and I think there's even more, less space between their two positions on this than probably at any time before,
Now, Ashraf, many of the changes in Egypt since Mubarak's ouster have been rolled back. Syria's civil war has gone on for more than 2 years. There's concern that the government there has used chemical weapons. Is there a sense that, and then some of the North African countries have also seen a lot of trouble. Is there a sense that this is the end of the Arab Spring, or is this still too early to tell? Or did the Arab Spring end a long time ago, for that matter?
Good question. There is a sense that the last 2 years have basically been bungled in Egypt, definitely. I mean, by almost any, I think the one thing that everyone can agree on is that the last few years just haven't gone well in Egypt. I guess the perspective depends, you know, everyone claims to be the one protecting the gains of the revolution. That's the point where we've reached at, is that the revolution and whatever it stood for is being used as common political currency. You know, everyone on all sides claims that they're the one protecting the revolution from the others. So, yeah, it hasn't gone well. It's incredibly depressing, and especially for those of us, you know, including Charles, who were here not only for the final Mubarak years and saw how depressed and dispirited and kind of self-loathing Egypt was like in those last 10 years under Mubarak, and saw that all kind of washed away in this euphoric 18-day people power thing. I mean, the possibilities in February 2011 really did seem endless, and now we just can't even begin to say that anymore.
Charles, last Friday there was a day of rage with protests throughout Egypt and that left hundreds of people dead. Well, tomorrow's Friday. Are there more protests planned, or has the bloodshed and the arrests of so many Muslim Brotherhood leaders over the last 2 weeks intimidated potential protesters?
I think there's definite conflicting views within the organization about, you know, what the best strategy is from here on out. And, you know, with some advocating sort of a more confrontational defiant approach and some advocating, a less defiant approach. There are calls for demonstrations tomorrow. It's not clear how it doesn't seem like they're going to be all that big, but it's hard to, you know, it's hard to predict, obviously.
Well, thank you both so much for being on our show, despite some of the difficulties with the phone lines. I've learned all sorts of things that I haven't learned from the regular news reports, and I am grateful to both of you, Charles Levinson, Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Ashraf Khalil, correspondent for Time magazine. His latest book, Liberation Square. It's been a pleasure, I guess.
Thanks a lot, Levinson.
Thank you, sir.